Welcome to My Better Half on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. When Deborah Whitman and her husband Glenn exchanged vows in 1999, they promised to love each other until they were 103. To some, the optimism sounded like a joke. But as an expert on aging, Deb knew the odds were in their favor to live that long. They were fit, well-educated, and financially secure, all factors that boost life expectancy. So they conducted their lives and retirement planning with that age as a target. Along the way, though, a danger was silently building in Glenn's body. The artery known as the widowmaker grew increasingly blocked until in 2017, at the age of 46, he had a heart attack while on a hike. He survived, but all the circumstances that had been necessary for his survival, which depended on things like government policy, geography, and community, made them both reconsider the complexity of longevity. The experience started her mission to determine why some of us live much longer and healthier lives than others. She shares her findings and recommendations in her new book, The Second 50, Answers to the 7 Big Questions of Midlife and Beyond. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You live in Maryland now, but I understand you're originally from the Pacific Northwest.
I am. I grew up in Eastern Washington State on the Columbia River near the Grand Coulee Dam. My hometown is Electric City, population about 900. And I went to Gonzaga undergrad. So I really miss the mountains out there and the coffee and all the great people.
Okay. Shout out to Washington then. And we'll look forward to some Pacific Northwest specific stats that you might have. To begin with, what are the 7 big questions you explore in your new book?
So they're the questions I wanted to know as I turned 50. So I've been working on aging issues for the last 25 years, whether it's here at AARP or I ran the Senate Aging Committee. I worked at the Social Security Administration. So I've been doing research on all of the things that happen to us as we age. But then I was going to hit 50 and I realized there was so much that I didn't know. And I looked at my bookshelf and there's What to Expect When You're Expecting. And my kids were headed to college. So there was really good books about planning for early life, but there really wasn't a guidebook for the second half. So I wrote down a list of questions, things very specific, like how long will I live and will I be healthy? I wanted to know some practical things like, will I have enough money and how long will I work? And then even some scary things. So will I lose my memory and how will I die? And those questions became a chapter, each chapter of the book. And I sort of dove in, what do we know is going on in the United States? I talked to experts. I interviewed people across the country to hear how people are living their second 50, and all that wove together into the book.
Okay, well, let's start with the first question. What are the current trends in life expectancy, both at the national level and at our state level, if you have that data?
Well, so what's really exciting is we've gained a lot of years of life. I mean, that's one of the huge gifts that, you know, in the turn of last century, the 1900s, people didn't even make it on average to age 50. And since then, we've gained over 30 years of life expectancy. But there's huge differences across the population in how long we live, and huge differences in a way that I didn't even realize. So I knew, for example, that women live longer than men. In America, women live on average 6 years longer than men. And part of that's our biology and part of it's women's behaviors. We are more likely to go to a doctor. We are less likely to go to war. We are prone to fewer accidents with our guns, for example. And then there's other differences. Racial and ethnic differences are huge. So Asian Americans can expect to live to 83. Our Native American population, I grew up next to the Colville Reservation. Native Americans can only expect to live till about 65. And remember, the retirement age in Social Security is going up to 67. So huge differences by race and ethnicity, educational differences. If you have a college education, you live 7 years longer than if you have only a high school or less. Income and wealth play a huge role. People at the top 1% live a decade longer than people at the bottom 1%. And then there's differences by geography. And this really shocked me and might shock your listeners. Where you live is your zip code is now more important than your genetic code. The differences across this country are huge. And I did a little checking on Oregon, and I found the county with the lowest life expectancy. You might have this be familiar, it's Jackson County. And this is life expectancy at birth, where Medford is. If you're born in Jackson County, you can expect to live to 66. If you live in Multnomah County, which is just outside of Portland, you can expect to live to 89. That's 23 years difference in life expectancy, which is just huge.
That is staggering. I never would have expected, as a resident of Jackson County, I never would have expected such a disparity. So you write in the second 50 that many of the institutions and policies that support older citizens are outdated. Yet some countries and U.S. states have created master plans for aging. And given what you just said about the zip code being such a determiner, I'm even more interested in this question. How are places like California getting it right?
So I think one of the things we need to look at is people aren't necessarily different in Multnomah versus Jackson County, right? We're all humans. We have the potential to live longer lives. And so looking at what really drives differences in life expectancy and trying to create strategies that help everyone to live a longer and healthy life is something that I'm trying to push in this book and really on in my career, my whole life. You know, one of the ways to do that is to have a plan. Most governments are kind of ignoring the fact that we're going to have this huge growth in the aging of the population. Some countries and states and localities are putting forth plans to say, okay, well, how do we have to think differently about housing? Because we're going to need more housing that's accessible and we're just not building it. How do we think about transportation? How do we think about healthcare for people with chronic diseases or who need extra help in their daily lives? And so many countries are putting together what are called national plans on aging. And some of the best of those that I've seen, you know, put resources and really make sure that there's funding for new programs, that the governments are integrating across different sectors, both the private and the public sector. And so California has put together a master plan that I talk about where they brought the aging and disability communities together and said, how can we eliminate some of these disparities? Now, I will say Oregon is a leader in that you do have a state plan for aging and you have a number of cities that are trying to become age friendly. So they're trying to think how as we as a community and what the needs are of our community. And Ashland actually is one of those cities that's part of ARP's network of age friendly cities and communities. So I guess what I'm asking people to think about is both in their own lives and for policymakers, how do we plan for our future that understands our lives are complicated as we age and that the systems that we have in place may not be the right ones as the population grows or as we age?
Right. So Jefferson Public Radio is based in Ashland on the campus of Southern Oregon University. Do you have more information on the city of Ashland's aging plan?
So I looked into it a little bit and I couldn't find too many details, but you know, I encourage citizens to ask their government, what are you doing? What more can you do? How can I get involved? The best way to make these plans is to really tailor them to the needs of the city. What works in Ashland probably wouldn't work in Portland or Salem. And so working together with community organizations, building on the resources and community connections that you already have is really the goal of these age-friendly cities and communities. And Oregon's also looking at being dementia-friendly too, because we're also seeing a rise in the number of people with cognitive decline and dementia as they age.
Okay. So that's the governmental side, municipalities, the national level, the state level. You also provide a roadmap for the private sector. So what are your three guiding priorities for enabling the healthiest, happiest senior population?
Yeah, so we need to make changes ourselves, right? We need to save for our future. We need to try as healthy as possible. But we also need some help. And so we talked about the government. We also need the private sector. So a key thing is we're having to work longer as we live longer. And so eliminating ageism, particularly in employment, where somebody who wants a job isn't getting an interview or getting hired just because of their age. They may be the best qualified person, but you know that costs not just that business from losing out on the talent and not just the worker from losing out on the paycheck, but it costs our entire economy. We could have a 4% larger GDP if all of the people who are older, who wanted to work, could and weren't kept from an aging. So that's number one. Employers also need to see the benefits of having a multi-generational workforce. We've done studies that show that businesses are more productive if they have a mix of talent and experience. So again, you know, not just ending ageism because it's bad, but actually seeing the value of having somebody with a lifetime of experience. We need to look at these disparities. So there's no reason that Multnomah and Jackson County should have 20 years life difference. Getting into why, what are those causes? What's the environment? What are the opportunities for people in different locations? I think also needs to be a key, and the private sector can get involved there. And then thinking about making sure, as I said, there's huge differences in life expectancy by education. How can our colleges and universities help ensure people have lifelong learning? Employers can make sure people have skills training throughout their life so that they can be active participants and keep their knowledge up to date as the environment changes.
And just a side note, you mentioned that we have a growing problem with dementia. And that requires a comprehensive approach too. In other words, it's not just having the infrastructure to have memory care for everybody who needs it, but isn't it true that early childhood education ends up being implicated in dementia rates?
It does. All education does. And part of, you know, using our brains our whole life actually helps protect us and lower our risk for getting cognitive decline and dementia. So even just if you quit your job and you're, you know, sitting around and not doing anything for 6 years, that was going to increase your chance of getting cognitive decline and dementia. So there's a lot we can do to lower our risk factor. Things like eating right, exercising, staying socially engaged and connected to others is a huge boost for our brain. As I said, exercise, doing cognitively stimulating activities, making sure our hearing is checked can reduce. If you don't use hearing aids and you are hard of hearing, there's a huge increase in your chance of getting dementia or cognitive decline. So there's a lot we as individuals can do too.
Okay. Well, that's about all the time that we have. Are there any last thoughts you'd like to share about this book or about the second 50 in general?
I think I'll end on a happy note, which is we're actually are happier as we age. So if you sort of plot over a life course, how happy people are, they're most happy when they're young. And they're most happy when they're old. It's our middle of our life where, you know, we're raising our kids and working and feeling lots of stress. That as we age, we tend to sort of accept, even, you know, if you ask somebody who's older, how's your health? Oh, it's good. Do you have any issues? Oh, yes, I have a heart disease and, you know, my back hurts and all these other things. But people have a generally positive view. And so for those that are afraid of their second 50, I just say, you know, there's lots of good things too.
Amen. And as you write, it's important we understand that the second half of life is also a period of growth, optimism, and meaningful participation. Okay, Debra Whitman, thank you so much for talking about your book, and best of luck to you.
Thanks for having me, Vanessa.
My guest today was Debra Whitman, author of The Second 50, Answers to the 7 Big Questions of Midlife and Beyond, and AARP's Chief Public Policy Officer. You've been listening to My Better Half on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. You can hear more episodes about thriving in the second half of life at jeffexchange.org. And subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. If you have an idea for a person or a topic on My Better Half, send me an email. You can reach me at finneyv@sou.edu.